Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the relationship between faulty genes and cancer? And what did it take for scientists to discover ways to treat certain cases of this deadly disease at their genetic roots? As my guest today will tell us, successful therapy for patients with chronic myeloid leukemia began with work done in the early days of genetic research, but took decades of persistent effort and advocacy to come to fruition. The new book by science writer Jessica Wapner is called The Philadelphia Chromosome, A Mutant Gene and the Quest to Cure Cancer at the Genetic Level. Jessica, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's start with the disease this book centers on. What is chronic myeloid leukemia, or CML, and how does it threaten lives?
So chronic myeloid leukemia is a disease of the white blood cells, as are all leukemias. The chronic refers to the fact that it progresses slowly, and slowly is a relative term because somebody diagnosed with CML left untreated would have about 4 to 6 years to live. What happens with CML is we get our bodies produce too many white blood cells that fail to mature. So they're abnormal white blood cells. They're useless in the body, and they take up all the space. So there's no room left for healthy blood cells to grow.
And the state of a patient's bone marrow can reveal the progression or the remission of the disease depending on where a patient is in treatment.
Yeah, there's different ways that can be measured. I mean, one of the telltale signs that CML is present is that a person has far too many white blood cells. So and sometimes that's how the disease gets diagnosed. A person might go in for a routine checkup and have a blood test, and there's too many white blood cells, the results will show.
So what kinds of therapies were used before the successful treatment we'll discuss today was finally developed?
There were two main treatments until the turn of the 21st century. There was interferon, which is a type of immune therapy. Interferon is a chemical that our bodies produce naturally, particularly, for example, when we have the flu virus, our bodies produce interferon to get rid of the virus. So all of the symptoms that we feel, the fever, the tiredness, that's interferon at work. So with somebody taking interferon synthetically, which was used to reduce blood counts in patients with CML, feels like they're walking around with the flu. And there's more beyond that. It can cause depression and severe problems, mental problems, things like that. It's a very, very harsh drug. The other treatment, which is still actually the only curative treatment, is a bone marrow transplantation. The tricky thing about a bone marrow transplantation is that, of course, not everybody is a candidate because you have to have an appropriate donor. And also, it's also very harsh. Only about half of the people who go through a bone marrow transplantation survive it. And it takes about a year to recover.
All right, so we'll step back here and start to talk about the basic science. What is the relationship between genes and cancer?
Well, in this disease, CML, the connection is very clear. The Philadelphia chromosome is a genetic mutation that leads directly to CML. That's not always the case with all cancers. Figuring out the relationship between cancer and genetics is one of the cutting edges of cancer research, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to write this book, because it's the origin story for why we're looking at genes at all. Why are we interested in understanding the relationship between genes and cancer? There are many types of cancer now, breast cancer, lung cancer, and many others, where subtypes of the disease, right, are driven by different genetic markers. Like we hear about BRCA or the BRCA1, BRCA2 gene that are associated with different types of breast cancer, for example. So different types of cancers are driven by different genetic mutations.
And the genes that are known to cause cancer are called oncogenes, is that right?
That's right. So oncogenes is a name that emerged in the 1970s to 1980s to describe genes that were once healthy or that we inherited as cancerous, that trigger cancer, right? So there's two ways that genetics can lead to cancer. One is through an inherited mutation, like BRCA1 or BRCA2.
So we always have those genes, but eventually they cause cancer in a lot of the people who have them.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. If you get you don't necessarily inherit the gene, but if you inherit the gene, you're always going to have the gene.
Right.
Mm-hmm. The other kind is a spontaneous mutation where you're alive for many years. There's no presence of this mutation in your body, and one day there is. One cell in your body, in CML, one cell in the bone marrow, undergoes a mutation and has now this Philadelphia chromosome, which can eventually lead to CML.
Okay, now we're going to take yet another step back. If you could tell us a little bit about the progression, just of the study of chromosomes in the first part of the 20th century.
Yeah, it's so interesting because when this chromosome was first discovered in 1959, there was barely any technology. And our understanding of chromosomes and genes, it goes hand in hand with the advent of technology to study those things, right? So in 1959, people had microscopes. So you could look at chromosomes barely. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're blurry.
Kind of fuzzy things, yeah.
Yeah, they're fuzzy. Like, focus that in, please. There must be a better way to look at these things. In 1971, a new technique called banding started to become available. Mm-hmm. That uses fluorescent dyes and a fluorescent microscope to look inside chromosomes. And I describe that in the book like, you're looking at a movie and somebody thinks to turn off the lights and now I can see it. Or moving from black and white film to color. I mean, it was that dramatic a shift where you can start to see inside chromosomes. Now, of course, there's all kinds of technology that allow us to sequence chromosomes, sequence genomes, and find out a whole lot more about what's going on underneath the surface.
And in the late 50s, when David Hungerford and Peter Noel were working together, it was a big deal just to get a usable slide to study.
Yes, that's right. They used to do what they called squashes, which is exactly what it sounds like. Hmm. You take the glass slide, which is this small rectangular slide, and the cover slip, which is this thin little plastic square, or sometimes it was glass, I think, both of them at that time, and squash it with your thumb to spread out the cells. So you put your drop of sample on, put the cover slip on, and then squash it to open up the cells so you could study what was going on inside.
So sometimes you'd get a usable sample and sometimes you'd just get a bunch of mush.
That's right. I mean, this was science. You know, it was hands-on, trying different kinds of experiments, and those were the techniques of the day. That was the technology of the day was, okay, now squash this cell sample with your thumb. And if the cell walls just burst open and all of the contents spilled out, then that sample was useless.
So how did Hungerford and Noel first make the link between leukemia and a chromosomal abnormality?
Well, when Peter Noel, who was a scientist at Fox Chase Cancer Center, and Peter Noel was at University of Pennsylvania, and David Hungerford was at Fox Chase Cancer Center, when they started working together looking at samples of chromosomes, they didn't really know what they were looking for. Peter Noel had happened to stumble across this technique that enabled people to see inside, gave a better view of chromosomes than people had before. Mm-hmm. David Hungerford was this, his wife described him as this old school scientist. He just loved to observe. He didn't need to make any breakthroughs. He didn't have a goal for where his research was going. When he spotted this one abnormally small chromosome in blood cells from patients with CML, he had no idea, was this driving the cancer or was the cancer leading to the mutation? It really wasn't clear. It wasn't until decades of research later that picture became clear, that the genetic mutation was driving the cancer.
And what he actually saw was this bizarre sort of swap of material from two specific chromosomes.
Right. So that actually wasn't found until 1971, when the banding technique became available. Right, because the problem just the case as things were in 1959, was that there wasn't anything he could do with it.
So he knew that one was wrong, two of them were the wrong size, but he couldn't say why.
He only knew that one was short.
Mm-hmm.
He knew that chromosome 22 was short. He didn't actually notice what Janet Rowley at the University of Chicago noticed in 1971. She had schooled herself in the banding techniques, and she was studying CML cells and noticed that not only was chromosome 22 too short, but chromosome 9 was a little too long. And she could also see, because of the banding, it's the stripes, these patterns of stripes that a chromosome will have in every sample. So she could see that the stripes that should have been on the one part of chromosome 9 were on chromosome 22. And the stripes that were on chromosome 22 were now on chromosome 9. It was what was called a translocation. And people didn't believe her at the time that it was important. And she was insistent that this translocation was somehow responsible for the cancer. She found two or three more of these translocations in other leukemias, and that was when people started to think, all right, maybe she knows what she's talking about. And she was correct. This translocation, this tiny swapping of genetic material, is enough to lead to this fatal leukemia.
It's easy to almost take some of this knowledge for granted now, but it was a big deal in the beginning just to figure out that there were 23 pairs of chromosomes in the human genome.
That's right. I mean, it's an amazing story how we even got to the number 46, 23 from each parent. There was all kinds of wild research that went on, which I chronicle a little bit in the book. There's even more, but I talk about how people were studying sperm cells from castrated patients in mental hospitals to count chromosomes. And it wasn't until, for a long time, people thought that it was 44 or 42. It was a good estimate. It was really close, but it wasn't until a man named Johan Chio, who was a scientist from Indonesia, was researching in Switzerland, and he had a whole amazing story of having been in a Japanese prison camp for years and how he survived and kept his sanity. He was an incredible researcher, trudging through the snow one night to go to the laboratory and just decided to look through the microscope one more time, just, you know, crossing his T's, dotting his I's, and counted up the chromosomes that he saw, and the number came to 46. And he was right, it was 46 chromosomes. Until we had that correct number, there was no universal language that scientists could speak when talking about chromosomes. You could never be sure that you were looking at the same chromosome in two different samples of cells. So that number was absolutely essential.
We're speaking this hour with science writer Jessica Wapner. Her new book is called The Philadelphia Chromosome, A Mutant Gene and the Quest to Cure Cancer at the Genetic Level. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, we would invite you to call 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is science writer Jessica Wapner. Her new book is called The Philadelphia Chromosome, A Mutant Gene and the Quest to Cure Cancer at the Genetic Level. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So until there was a clear link between CML, chronic myeloid leukemia, and a chromosomal abnormality, there wasn't much that science could do with the information. Once it was established that there was obviously a relationship between these two things, what course did scientists take then?
That was a very big aha moment for many people. One of those people was Brian Druker, who is one of the heroes of this story. He was an academic researcher and cancer doctor. There were also people who were, people as far as Israel, Japan, researchers in a drug company in Switzerland, who were seeing this picture emerge of how research had described the exact mechanism through which this genetic mutation led to CML, saying, well, if we know that, could we make a drug to block it? Could we create a compound that could just be the wrench in the clockwork? And that was a revolutionary way to think about cancer treatment, because up until then, the treatments were chemotherapy and radiation and surgery. But if we think about chemotherapy in terms of medication, it was carpet bombing the body in the hopes of killing the cancer cells. It was sort of a blanket, very general approach. This was saying, well, let's get it at the mechanism it's using to grow. Let's get it at its root cause. Now it was possible to think that that could work.
What was the relationship between these new burgeoning ideas and research that had been done that linked viruses with cancers in chickens?
It's such a great story. That's one of my favorite stories in the book, about this farmer in 1910 who brought her tumor-ridden chicken to a man named Peyton Rouse at Rockefeller University on the Upper East Side in Manhattan, and asked him if he would surgically remove the tumor. It had this big knob sticking out of its belly. I have a picture of it in the book. And he agreed. He performed chicken surgery right in his laboratory. The chicken died, but he had this tumor and figured, well, let me see what I can find out about it. Let me see what I can find out about the cancer. He ground it up and took it through all kinds of processes until he had this kind of extract, and he took that extract and he injected it into another chicken, and the next chicken got the same cancer. First one. And he said, okay, that must be transmissible cancer. What was important about that moment was not so much that he had found a virus that caused cancer in chickens, as interesting as that is. The meaning that discovery had for this story was that research of that virus, which became known as the Rouse sarcoma virus, eventually led to the understanding of the genetic underpinnings of cancer. It took years of research. That was in 1910, and it was in the 1970s that Harold Varmus, who's currently the head of the NCI, and Mike Bishop figured out that genes that were healthy could become oncogenes, right? So we discussed this term, oncogenes. So you can have a proto-oncogene, a healthy gene, that has the capacity to mutate, and in that mutated state, trigger cancer.
So what was the significance of discovering that RNA and not DNA was responsible for, am I correct about this, for creating certain oncogenes?
Well, that was part of really the legacy of the viral research, and what I chronicle in the story is how the study of viruses led to the study of cancer, how viruses were such a good way to understand how cancer happened, to study it happening in a petri dish, because a virus is comprised of just a few genes. It's RNA or DNA, and the way that they arise, the way that they can pick up genes from its host, allows a scientist to study cancer occurring, because that's what scientists wanted to do for so many years. They wanted to watch cancer happen. They wanted to watch a normal cell become cancerous to see what they could understand. So they would take these cancer-causing viruses and inject them into cells and try to watch it transforming, and also try to isolate what was it about the virus that was causing the cancer, which is how they eventually stumbled on the fact that it was genetics, that there was a gene that the virus had picked up from a host, right? So that chicken virus wasn't always in way, way back in time. There was a time when that chicken virus did not cause cancer. But one time it got into a chicken and would have scooped up a gene into its viral genome. And when that gene got scooped up, it mutated. And in that mutated state, it became cancer-causing, right? So the virus was doing just fine on its own, but now it had this new gene involved, and that gene mutated and was causing cancer in chickens. Now, in humans, we don't have, some cancers are caused by viruses or linked to viruses, but that's about 20% or so. But it can happen without viruses. But it was the use of the viruses that led to our understanding of how it all goes down.
So how did scientists start to think about proteins when they were considering possible therapies for particular kinds of cancer, particular oncogenes?
Well, when this picture became clear between the Philadelphia chromosome and CML, that picture involves a protein, right? So the Philadelphia chromosome is a mutant gene that encodes a mutant protein. The healthy version of the gene encodes a healthy protein, but the mutant protein is what triggers this production of white blood cells. And so scientists were wondering, scientists in academia, scientists in drug companies, were wondering, is there a way to create a compound that can block the signal that this protein gives to produce white blood cells?
So what kinds of substances had already been developed that were tested in this way, and how was the drug that would eventually become used for this developed?
There was a drug called, or a compound called storosporine, which was an antifungal agent that one person was using in Israel. There were other compounds that people were starting to test out to see if they could block the protein. There was a drug company named Sibagaigi in Switzerland, which was one of the first drug companies to have a kinase inhibitor program. So this protein I just spoke about, the mutant protein encoded by the Philadelphia chromosome, is a type of protein known as a kinase, which is an enzyme that starts reactions in a cell, starts processes in a cell. So people were trying out different compounds, and in the drug company, they knew about the research in Israel or elsewhere. Every time somebody has a success, they're publishing it, right, and then building on that next success. That's how science works. So inside the drug company, they start their kinase program and start stringing together chemicals to see if any of them will get inside the cell and block this protein from working.
And so how are these sorts of ideas tested initially? There are lab experiments, there are animals. What does it take to bring something up to the level of human trials?
Before a drug would ever be tested in a human, first of all, it's not called a drug before it's tested in a human. It's called a compound, really. Because a drug is something that does something.
Right.
When they're testing it out inside the drug company, it would be tested out on cell lines. So a very general cell line to look at whether the drug is potent and selective and active. Is it getting into the cell? Is it getting to this specific kinase? And is it doing anything? Is it active against the cell? Before a compound would even leave the drug company laboratory, it has to satisfy those three requirements. And I remember, you know, Elizabeth Buchtinger, who was one of the biologists at Ciba-Geigy, telling me about this process and how, you know, it took a couple of years. And then only after that would the drug be tested in an academic setting. So Brian Druker, who I mentioned, was testing these compounds from Ciba-Geigy. They sent him a bunch of compounds, and he tested all of them out on leukemia cells and saw right away that one of them was killing the cells. One of them worked. They were unmarked. The drug company knew which one there was their lead compound. They knew which one they thought was going to kill leukemia cells, but they didn't tell him. They just called them A, B, C, D, E. And so that if whatever he saw, they could trust, and he could trust. So they were killing it was killing CML cells, and he went back to the company and said, okay, this one compound is working. And as Elizabeth Buchtinger put it to me, when she heard that, she says, that was already a little bit of a miracle, that it could work in a Petri dish.
And Druker, of course, had seen human beings suffering from this very devastating disease.
Yes. And so, you know, talking about the progression of things, so once he saw that, he says, okay, time to test this out on animals, because if this is doing this, having this effect on CML cells, well, you've got to get testing this in animals so that if it's working, if it's safe, we can try it out in a human clinical trial, because this is a fatal disease. Yes, we have interferon. Yes, we have bone marrow transplantation, but patients die from CML, and patients with any type of cancer need better treatments. So not only is there a possibility that this drug is going to help patients with a fatal disease, there's also the possibility that we're going to prove a principle that blocking kinases, that blocking cancer at its root cause, is possible and effective. So he says, get this into animal studies, and but nothing happened for quite a while. It took a long time.
Why didn't anything happen?
Well, there were a couple of reasons, and they crop up over and over again. From the time that Ciba-Geigy started its kinase program to the time that the drug was approved was 18 years. So one of the reasons was that this was a new principle, as we talked about. This was a new principle, and so there was a risk involved. Nobody had ever tried blocking a kinase. Could you create a compound that gets into a cell and can block one single protein? If that drug blocked more than one protein, as one investigator said it to me, that is going to be one sick patient. So there was that kind of risk. There was also, though, a huge financial risk. CML is a rare disease. It is diagnosed in about 5,000 people per year in the United States. By comparison, breast cancer is diagnosed in about 230,000 people in the U.S. each year. So making a drug, going through everything that would be required to make a new drug, all of the cost involved in that, for a disease that occurred in so few people, when there's a patient population, that, as it's called in the drug industry, that's the market, right? So the market is too small to guarantee a return on the investment. And that financial bottom line was a major reason for delays, for why this drug did not get into animals and did not get into human trials as soon as it should have.
The question of whether the drug might have blocked more than one protein, that essentially, the idea there is that it would, if that were the case, it would create side effects that could wreak havoc on someone's health.
Absolutely. I mean, kinases, as I said, we have all kinds of kinases. There's all kinds of proteins in our cells. So the idea that you could make a compound that would fit, that would lock on to just one specific protein, I mean, it has a kind of a science fiction twinge to it, and it had never been done before. So, yeah, I mean, if they're triggering all kinds of things in our cells, then blocking some other thing from happening could be seriously harmful or deadly.
So what role did Brian Druker play in actually pushing this thing through that was expensive, that would only serve a small number of even cancer patients in this country?
Brian Druker was tireless in his efforts to get this drug out of the laboratory and into clinical trials for patients, into the hospital where patients could access it. He fought tirelessly, arguing with the drug company that no matter how many animal studies they did, they were never going to get a clear answer on whether the drug worked in people. So to give one anecdote, there was a time where the drug was causing liver problems in dogs. And there was a moment where somebody at the drug company said, "Not over my dead body is this compound going to get into humans." Brian Druker's argument was, okay, you're seeing liver problems in dogs, but in a clinical trial, we monitor patients every day. If I see the slightest sign of a liver problem, I'm going to stop giving the drug to patients. In animal studies, that's not what happens, right? They're giving doses of the drug that you would not do in a normal setting. Or if you were, you would then stop the drug. I mean, that's just part of how cancer is treated, and that's part of how clinical trials are done. It's extremely careful monitoring. So he's saying, you know, the dose is never going to get that high, and we're never going to let liver problems get out of control. So that was one, you know, example of the kind of arguing that he was doing. At one point, he went to the FDA, kind of, you know, behind the drug company's back in a way, to say, look, this is the animal data that we have so far. Is this sufficient for a clinical trial, you know, theoretically speaking?
Let me jump in because we have to take a quick break, and we'll talk more about this FDA sort of subterfuge in a minute. My guest is science writer Jessica Wapner. We're talking about her new book, The Philadelphia Chromosome, A Mutant Gene and the Quest to Cure Cancer at the Genetic Level. Join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with science writer Jessica Wapner. Her new book is called The Philadelphia Chromosome, A Mutant Gene and the Quest to Cure Cancer at the Genetic Level. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. And before the break, Jessica, you were telling us about the very persistent, very dedicated Dr. Brian Druker going to the FDA and sort of lobbying them for support in getting this drug developed.
Right. Well, the drug company was telling him that they had to continue testing the drug in animals. And he's saying, no, you need to get the drug into humans. That's what you need to do. Whatever, you can study this drug in monkeys for the next 10 years. In the end, all you're going to know is how the drug is working in monkeys. Mm-hmm. Give the drug a chance. And yes, part of that was going to the FDA and getting their take on the matter. Part of that was writing letters to people inside the drug company. Now, he wasn't the only person fighting for this drug. There were people inside the company. And, of course, in the end, the company did the right thing. But many people told me, from people from inside the company, patients, that without him, it is very likely this drug may not have been made at all.
How successful has it been in human beings?
This drug has been very successful. It is 12 years since the drug was approved in 2001. It was the fastest FDA approval ever. And there are people who were on those early clinical trials who are still alive, people from who were in the very first round of the studies who are still alive. The drug the benefits of the drug were seen very early on. Just a few months into the trial, patients started experiencing their blood counts were normalizing, they were feeling better, and that continued. So whether it's Gleevec or now there's second and third generation versions of the drug, these drugs are incredibly successful. And that's why this story is so important, because it stands as a proof of principle.
And Gleevec ultimately was the sort of commercial name of this drug.
That's right.
And patients do, once they're on it, it doesn't cure them. It simply keeps the leukemia under control?
Yes. They have to keep taking the drug once a day. It's a pill. It can be swallowed once a day. And as, for the most part, patients need to take it for the rest of their lives, and they can live a normal, healthy life.
Sounds astonishing.
Yeah.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone to Anne in Dallas. Hi, Anne.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
And I first want to say, like, my son is a pediatric cancer patient with neuroblastoma. And much like you said, or what was said earlier today, is that it takes a yeoman's job to get some of these drugs to market for populations or target markets that are less than desirable by private industry. Hmm. Historically, the government, many people would say that, oh, you know, private industry will take care of it if there's a market for it. But many cancers like neuroblastoma and some leukemias don't have that target market. And so my son was treated traditionally, responded somewhat, and recently relapsed with neuroblastoma. And we found, because we kept in the business in terms of always keeping on top of things, that Children's Hospital of Philadelphia discovered an ALK mutation, and therefore he's on something called crizotinib, which is an ALK inhibitor, which is a kinase inhibitor, which has made a material impact on his disease. And it might not work for all children, but it's important for everyone to know, your audience to know, if we need to privately fund through different organizations and try to lobby our government to look at these target markets that might not be as broad for big business, because there's much to be learned and gained. And I appreciate the book. I'm going to get it because there's so much to be learned in cancer research. And if people only knew how little was out there for them, they too would kind of raise the roof and get the word out. So I appreciate the author and her contribution to that movement.
Well, great points, Anne, and our best wishes for your son and his continued health.
Yeah.
Do you want to respond to that, Jessica?
Well, I thought an interesting note about that is the fact that one of the reasons why this drug for a rare disease was possible to bring to market was the Orphan Drug Act, which was from 1983. That was for rare diseases. There was a big problem that drug companies were not focusing on rare diseases at all. And this law in 1983 provided a bunch of incentives, financial incentives, that enabled companies to, you know, it allayed the took the edge off, let's say. Since the Orphan Drug Act was passed in 1983, now there's hundreds of orphan drugs on the market. And now subtypes of cancer are sometimes qualifying for rare disease status. And this drug showed that you could create a successful, profitable drug for a rare disease. And I think the drug she's referring to, crizotinib, she said, was actually approved for a subtype of lung cancer.
Hmm.
That's a kinase inhibitor, the same type of drug that was for a subtype of lung cancer.
And I guess the wonderful thing about these kinase inhibitors is that, unlike sort of generic forms of chemotherapy, you're able to really target the cells that are causing a problem and leave healthy cells undisturbed, largely.
Yes, one of the equally stunning results with this drug early on was not just that blood counts were normalizing and that the number of cells containing this Philadelphia chromosome mutation were diminishing, but that patients felt great.
Hmm.
There were stories of patients who were brought into the clinic in the wheelchair, oxygen mask. There's one story of a patient, LaDonna LaPasa was her name. She had chosen her burial plot when she was enrolled in a clinical trial for this drug. And that was 10 years ago, 12 years ago, and she was the sickest patient to ever join a clinical trial for Gleevec. She's still alive.
Hmm.
And not just alive, I mean alive. She's vibrant. and the side effects were minimal. I'm not saying there's no side effects. There's pain early on. There's cramping, and some patients will do better with it than others. But it was nothing compared to the nausea, fatigue, numbness, and just, you know, string of problems that never ends with chemotherapy.
We have an email here from Stephen who says, at the time the Philadelphia chromosome was found and presumed to be causing CML, was that hypothesis controversial? It had been less than 10 years since the double helix structure was elucidated and genetics molecular biology was in its infancy.
As far as I know, it was not controversial. I don't know what it felt like in that moment, but no, it wasn't controversial. What it did was it set off a string of research, a flurry of research, to try to find other mutations like this, because that's all people could do, was look for more. And there was one that was at some called the Christchurch chromosome. It was discovered in Christchurch, New Zealand, that turned out to not be related to cancer after all. That was what people were looking for, and in fact, the Philadelphia chromosome, so in the scientific literature, it's abbreviated as PH, and it was actually called PH1 at the time because people figured there would be a PH2 and a PH3, other chromosomes discovered in Philadelphia or any other city that would be relevant to cancer. It wasn't controversial. It was just that nobody knew what it was all about. It was a mystery.
Does anybody know what causes the mutation?
It's spontaneous. There have been, researches to see, is this triggered by an environmental factor of some kind? As far as is known right now, no environmental factor has been identified that triggers this particular genetic mutation.
What are the implications of this story for the broader fight against all kinds of cancer?
This story puts us at the origin for this current moment in cancer research. So two things, the search to, on the one hand, sequence tumors and find the genetic sequence of a tumor and then shape treatment around that. And also the whole era of personalized medicine, the whole notion that understanding our genome is beneficial at all, the origins of that can be found in this story. And as we discuss healthcare, as we see the cost of healthcare as well, and the cost of cancer drugs, I think this story equips us with the knowledge to bring to those discussions, to bring to those debates. It shows us how we got to this point, what it takes to make a viable scientific discovery, and gives us a glimpse at where we're heading.
Is most of this kind of research done by private companies looking to develop a marketable product? Is it done at the university level? Is it done with government funding?
All of the above. And that's one of the messages that Brian Druker had, and that I talk about in the book, is that industry and academia and federal government regulators, it needs to all work together. No one area has the answer, has the only way to get it to the answer. All of it needs to work together. The basic science that gets funded by the National Institutes of Health is essential. None of this would have happened without that. It's absolutely crucial because you never know where a discovery is going to lead to. That's so obvious from this story. You just can't, you fund the research for the sake of funding the research, trusting that it will lead somewhere. But then without, the research also goes on at the drug company, and they also have the funds to get a clinical trial underway. And then you also need the federal regulators who can help facilitate all of that to happen.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Stephen in Euless. Hi, Stephen.
Hello. My daughter's fiance has recently been diagnosed 5 weeks ago with AML. And they are talking about a genetic marker, the FLT3. Mm-hmm. Does the author know anything about that, or is that related to this Philadelphia?
Right. Yeah, I have to refresh myself to know if there's drugs that are targeted specifically against mechanisms that are encoded by FLT3. But that's FLT3 is what it is. So if you're trying to research it, don't spell it FLIT. FLT3 is a genetic marker associated with AML and other diseases.
Excuse me for interrupting. AML is acute myeloid leukemia.
Right.
Okay.
Yes, I'm sorry. So faster progressing. And I'm sorry to hear about that in your family. FLT3 is something that's been detected in that cancer and some other ones. That's a focus of research at the moment.
One thing that did strike me, Jessica, was that, 60 years ago, scientists were saying, we're going to have this cancer thing beaten in a decade. And it always seems like we're just on the threshold. Is this truly a step forward that maybe brings us closer to that being a true statement?
That's the vision. I mean, the way that Brian Druker describes his vision is a Gleevec for every cancer. Right, I mean, that's the dream. This is a fatal disease, and we've all been touched by it somehow. We all know somebody that's been going through treatment. It kills a lot of people and brings a lot of suffering. So the vision is certainly to find a cure or turn it into this chronic condition, as it has with CML, that can be lived with. However, it might be that we're at the start of a new era. That's 20 years or 50 years in coming. As Brian Druker described to me, that tumor sequencing is sort of the next wave, and that's, maybe he puts that at kind of 20 years out. But certainly finding the genetic underpinnings, finding the driver mutations of cancer is the leading edge of cancer research. It's at the leading edge of cancer research. Understanding that cancer is a genetic disease has been a huge breakthrough, and that wasn't known about when that proclamation was made during the Nixon administration. Today we know so much more about the genetic triggers of cancer and how to treat cancer at the genetic level.
The new book by science writer Jessica Wapner is called The Philadelphia Chromosome, A Mutant Gene and the Quest to Cure Cancer at the Genetic Level. Jessica, thank you so much for joining us this hour.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our executive producer, and today he also answered phones. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming shows, and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. And we always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. Email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.